Just as today two different news channels can report events with their own particular spin, so too in the Bible. Much of the action recorded in the second book of Chronicles has already been reported in the second book of Kings, but the audiences couldn't be more different. Kings' original readers are exiled Jews in Babylon, languishing some 900 miles from their spiritual homeland of Judah. Their fabulous temple is in ruins, as is the fabled city of Zion, Jerusalem, founded by their golden king, David. These ragtag survivors need to know how this has happened so that it never happens to them again. Meanwhile, the Book of Chronicles is for the returnees whose initial zeal has cooled and who now find themselves living amongst the rubble of their former homeland. These people need encouragement, direction, and purpose. They need reminding of the glorious bloodline of David, how it has survived, and why keeping on side with God is critical to their ongoing survival. My name is Chas Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible Episode 99, The Few. Welcome to the season finale of the second book of Chronicles. This really isn't one of the Bible's most read books. It has no standout quotes and few original characters, and its best stories are told elsewhere, stealing much of its thunder. Still, we're covering every base here at Holy Bible, as those of you who stuck with us through the episode on moulds, rashes and boils from the book of Leviticus well know. As for me, I'm an advertising creative director, not a priest nor a theologian. But with the Bible underpinning three major world religions, this is a book with a lot to sell. For reference, the Bible I refer to is the NIV UK edition. Okay, let's take 2 Chronicles home. Unlike in the second book of Kings, here in Chronicles, the pagan-worshipping, child-sacrificing king of Judah, Manasseh, humbles himself and returns to worshipping God. However, his son Amon remains avowedly pagan. In this account of the monarchy, Judah's next king is really just a footnote. Both the second books of Kings and Chronicles agree that Manasseh's son Amon is evil. He worships the same gods as his father, but fails to see the error of his ways, and only digs himself deeper into trouble with God. His reign is a brief one. He is assassinated by his own officials in his palace. Concerned that the Davidic bloodline might now end, the people of Judah rise up to kill the assassins before one of them can declare themselves king. Once the men have been dispatched, Amon's 8-year-old son is placed on the throne. Few kings of Judah have been as saintly as Josiah, and when he grows up, Judah's new ruler seems every bit as focused on God as David, the great Jewish king to whom all kings of Israel and Judah are compared in the Bible. The accounts of Josiah's good and godly life told in both the second book of Kings and Chronicles are almost identical. Readers learn of the vigour with which the young king attacks the paganism of his father, ridding Judah's high places of altars, Asherah poles, idols, and shrines to the pagan god Baal. They hear of Josiah's rediscovery of the Book of the Law during the temple refurbishment, and how he reads it aloud to the people. They learn of the promise made by Huldah, the prophetess, that Judah is doomed, but, thanks to his godliness, Josiah will not live to witness any of the horrors. The newly cleansed temple celebrates Passover, possibly for the first time since it was observed by Josiah's great-grandfather, Hezekiah. The only difference in the accounts is the order in which they all happen, and the detail which each event is given. Kings spends more time describing the religious reforms put in place throughout the country, while Chronicles dedicates almost an entire chapter to the Passover celebration, naming the priests, numbering the sacrificial animals, 30,000 sheep and goats and 3,000 bulls, describing the offerings, and even the positioning of the musicians.
Only the account of Josiah's death is different in each book.
In Kings, the 26th dynasty pharaoh, Necho II, is en route to fight the Assyrians and is interrupted by Josiah when he passes through Judah. In the ensuing fight, which takes place at Megiddo, also known as Armageddon, Josiah is killed. In the second book of Chronicles, Necho assures Josiah that he has no beef with Judah. He is fulfilling an order from God to attack Assyria. In an uncharacteristic attempt to go against what appear to be God's wishes, Josiah disguises himself and fights Necho anyway, losing his life in the process. The king is shot by archers and is taken back to Jerusalem by chariot to die. The chronicler adds that the prophet Jeremiah writes laments about the king, which are still being sung at the point at which the book is written, suggesting the great respect and love which the people have for Judah's last godly king. Incidentally, the account of Josiah's death is the only mention of Jeremiah in the books of Kings and Chronicles. The Passover celebrated by Josiah is the last great godly event in Judah and marks a golden age before the collapse of the kingdom. Unlike Hezekiah in the previous episode, Josiah manages to get his Passover off the ground in the correct month. All the requisite priests have been consecrated, and so he has none of the problems which impeded his great-grandfather. The Levites are ordered to place the Jews' most precious artifact, the Ark of the Covenant, back in the sacred place designated for it in the temple. Why it has been removed, when, or by whom, is not explained. The Ark is believed to have contained the stone tablets on which are inscribed the Ten Commandments, and lives in its own special room called the Holy of Holies. There could be a number of reasons why the Ark is not in the Holy of Holies. It could have been placed to one side by Manasseh or his son Amon in favour of an idol. It could have been squirreled away by devout priests to protect it from these kings. Or it might simply have been moved to enable Josiah's refurbishment. If you're new here and simply hit the Play Later's episode button, the Levites are men from the tribe of Levi who officiate at the Jerusalem temple. These men are told to carry out their duties according to the system laid down by David before the temple was even built. Each family group from the tribe of Levi is invited to the court of the priests, where lambs are slaughtered, people are purified, and the food shared among everyone in line with the strict rules laid down in the Jewish law book. The temple itself constitutes the room where the Ark is kept, the Holy of Holies, and a second room, the Holy Place, with an altar, a golden table, and a lampstand. There are also storerooms and rooms for the priests, but much of the temple complex is external and forms two courtyards. The larger outer courtyard is for the people, while the smaller inner courtyard is especially for Levites, hence its name, the Court of the Priests. Josiah himself supplies all the animals for the people to offer up at the temple, which, though generous, isn't exactly a huge sacrifice for them. A total of 33,000 lambs, goats, and cattle belonging to the king are made ready. Inspired by their leader, Josiah's officials contribute just under 3,000 beasts to the priests, Levites, and their families. Six Levite leaders also step up, and between them provide 5,500 offerings for their people. Once the signal is given to begin, the lambs are killed and their blood splashed on the altar by the priests, while the carcasses are handed to the Levites to be skinned. The portions of the lambs and bulls that are to be burned are handed to each family group to give to the Levites, who do everything according to the book, serving the food as soon as it is cooked. The Levites then prepare sacrifices for themselves and the priests and continue slaughtering and cooking animals until nightfall. Temple musicians provide a celebratory backdrop, and the Levites guarding the temple gates are brought food by their colleagues so they needn't leave their posts. The event lasts 7 days, and the chronicler tells readers that no such Passover has been celebrated since the prophet Samuel was alive, some 4.5 centuries earlier. This is Judah's last hurrah, but anyone who has read the second book of Kings knows it's too little, too late. Josiah's piety can't rescue Israel from the evil that previous kings have either encouraged or turned a blind eye to, and from now on, it's a slow freewheel to oblivion. The catastrophic events of the final three chapters of the second book of Kings only fill a single chapter of Chronicles, but the end result is the same. A sequence of witless kings are powerless to prevent their once proud nation from becoming a scion of the Babylonian Empire. Jerusalem's fall is such a pivotal event in the Old Testament that it is recorded in three books of the Bible, here in the second book of Chronicles, earlier in the second book of Kings, and later in the book of Jeremiah. The rout begins with a power play from the south. Egypt's pharaoh Necho dethrones Josiah's son Jehoahaz after just 3 months on Judah's throne, an incident which the second book of Kings and Chronicles both agree on. Jehoahaz is taken captive to Egypt and his brother Eliakim placed on the throne, more as a regional governor for Egypt. The books agree that this comes at great financial cost to Judah, which has to pay the invaders punishing amounts of silver and gold in tax. Humiliatingly for a king, Eliakim has his name changed to Jehoiakim, and during what can only loosely be described as his reign, Judah is invaded by Babylon. For the next 3 years, Jehoiakim must send treasure and other goodies Babylon's way rather than to Necho, which he's recorded as doing in this book. However, in the second book of Kings, Jehoiakim rebels, possibly in the blind hope that Egypt will protect him. He backs the wrong horse. Siding with Necho is a catastrophic mistake, and when much of Egypt is conquered by Babylon's Nebuchadnezzar, Judah is left staring down the twin barrels of utter annihilation. It's a tough roll of the dice for Egypt too, as Necho is believed to have helped Babylon overthrow Assyria and has now seen his own country subjugated by his former ally. Here in the second book of Chronicles, Nebuchadnezzar helps himself to some of the temple treasures, and in both books, Jehoiakim is dragged in irons to Babylon. In the second book of Kings, however, he simply rests with his ancestors, which suggests a more natural death. It's now time for Jehoiakim's 18-year-old son, Jehoiachin, to take command of Judah, and both the second books of Kings and Chronicles see the young king as utterly hopeless. The second book of Chronicles notes that Jehoiachin is taken to Babylon with yet more temple treasures, but makes no mention of the deportation of all Judah's other high-status residents. The second book of Kings lists who is taken and the year of the siege, while Chronicles only jots down the absolute basics, almost in note form, as if in disgust. As in the earlier book, Zedekiah is then put on Judah's throne by Nebuchadnezzar. Zedekiah is yet another, quote, boy king. At 21, he's only a couple of years older than his two predecessors when they took the throne. The king fails to take the advice given by his prophet and wingman Jeremiah, a dropped ball that is pointed out by both the chronicler and Jeremiah himself. Like someone told not to press the red button who then can't help pressing the red button, Zedekiah also fails to fall in line with Nebuchadnezzar, despite having sworn an oath before God that he would do so. Oath-breaking is not only a complete Bible no-no, Zedekiah's cack-handed attempt at rebellion is the final straw for Babylon's king. In another biblical faux pas, Zedekiah resolutely refuses to follow God, and, as if falling in line behind their king, Judah's priests and other leaders allow pagan rites into their spiritual life and desecrate the temple as a result. According to the chronicler, God pities his people and repeatedly sends them prophets, but they mock these men and women and have no time for their messages. This is seen as behaviour which arouses God's anger to the point where he cannot be placated. As punishment, Babylon's army cuts down Judah's priests in their temple and slaughters its men and women, including the old and the sick. This time, Nebuchadnezzar carries away everything that is left in the temple before leaving it a pile of smoking rubble. He then smashes down Jerusalem's city walls and all its palaces. Among the valuables believed to have been lost that day are the Ark of the Covenant, along with all its sacred contents, and it is without doubt one of the darkest days in the Old Testament. Fans of the Indiana Jones franchise might be disappointed to hear that the Ark is not in a wooden crate inside a giant warehouse. Some believe it resides in the St. Mary of Zion Cathedral in the Ethiopian town of Aksum. Others believe that it was discovered by crusaders in the Holy Land and brought back to Chartres Cathedral in northern France. The sadder reality might be that it was simply melted down for its gold and its contents discarded, in which case the stone tablets may lie buried somewhere in modern-day Iraq. No mention is made in the Book of Chronicles of Zedekiah's escape attempt, nor his humiliating punishment at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. All readers are told is that a few survivors are rounded up and carried into exile in Babylon. Here they become servants of Babylon's kings until the Persians take over. It is possible that all four of Judah's last kings are still alive after the fall of Jerusalem. Jehoahaz might still be held captive in Egypt. Jehoiakim might be languishing in a Babylonian prison. Jehoiachin is allowed to eat at the king of Babylon's table, and Zedekiah might have survived his blinding. The chronicler tries to put a positive spin on the events, describing the 70-year Sabbath enjoyed by the land while its people are in exile, a fact that is predicted accurately by Jeremiah. Unlike Jeremiah and the writer of the second book of Kings, the chronicler doesn't mention the release from prison of Jehoiachin. Instead, he fast forwards to the decree by Cyrus in 539 BC, which he also notes was promised by Jeremiah, and which allows all the captive Israelites to return home. Without trying to be too much of a plot spoiler, the Israelites are eventually released from exile in Babylon. The books of Chronicles are aimed squarely at these returnees. By the time this happens, Babylon has been defeated by Persia, and it is the Persian king Cyrus who is now in charge of most of the ancient Near East, and it is Cyrus who allows the Jews to return home. In this book, Cyrus comes across as somewhat of a convert. He claims that God has given him every kingdom on earth to rule, and that he has commissioned him to build a temple in Jerusalem. Persia's king then gives permission for any Jewish captives to travel to Jerusalem, effectively signing their exit papers. His decree is seen as an act of God in the Bible, made all the more remarkable as Cyrus is not a Jew. It is these few believers, this pitiful remnant of Judah, overwhelmed at the task ahead of them, who are the first readers and the primary audience for this book. It may provide them with a map of how they came to be here, but what lies ahead of them is a blank page. The suggestion is that Judah's people can choose to follow God or risk losing everything all over again. The books of Chronicles have reached an end, but the Israelites' next adventure is only just beginning. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. If you like what you're hearing, please do tell your family and friends. You can send any comments or feedback to contact@holybible.com or join in the conversation on X. Just search Holy Bible Podcast. And if you're feeling generous, why not give us a 5-star rating wherever you're listening? Thank you.